Chapter 6. The Scene of the Crime. Between them, the doctor and Monsieur Hoté carried the unconscious woman into the house. The commissary looked after them, shaking his head.
"Pauvre femme," he murmured to himself. "The shock was too much for her. Well, well, we can do nothing. And now, Monsieur Poirot, shall we visit the place where the crime was committed?"
"If you please, Monsieur Bex."
We passed through the house and out by the front door. Poirot had looked up at the staircase in passing and shook his head in a dissatisfied manner.
"It is to me incredible that the servants heard nothing. The creaking of that staircase, with three people descending it, would awaken the dead."
"It was the middle of the night, remember. They were sound asleep by then." But Poirot continued to shake his head as though not fully accepting the explanation. On the sweep of the drive he paused, looking up at the house.
"What moved them in the first place to try if the front door were open?
It was a most unlikely thing that it should be. It was far more probable that they should at once try to force a window."
"But all the windows on the ground floor are barred with iron shutters," objected the commissary.
Poirot pointed to a window on the first floor.
"That is the window of the bedroom we have just come from, is it not? And see, there is a tree by which it would be the easiest thing in the world to mount."
"Possibly," admitted the other.
"But they could not have done so without leaving footprints in the flower bed."
I saw the justice of his words. There were two large oval flower beds planted with scarlet geraniums on each side of the steps leading up to the front door. The tree in question had its roots actually at the back of the bed itself, and it would have been impossible to reach it without stepping on the bed.
"You see," continued the commissary, "owing to the dry weather, no prints would show on the drive or paths, but on the soft mould of the flower bed it would have been a very different affair."
Poirot went close to the bed and studied it attentively. As Bex had said, the mould was perfectly smooth. There was not an indentation on it anywhere. Poirot nodded, as though convinced, and we turned away, but he suddenly darted off and began examining the other flower bed.
"Monsieur Bex," he called, "see here. Here are plenty of traces for you."
The commissary joined him and smiled.
"My dear Monsieur Poirot, those are without doubt the footprints of the gardener's large hobnail boots. In any case, it would have no importance, since this side we have no tree, and consequently no means of gaining access to the upper story."
"True," said Poirot, evidently crestfallen. "So you think these footprints are of no importance?"
"Not the least in the world."
Then, to my utter astonishment, Poirot pronounced these words,
"I do not agree with you. I have a little idea that these footprints are the most important things we have seen yet."
Monsieur Beck said nothing, merely shrugged his shoulders. He was far too courteous to utter his real opinion.
"Shall we proceed?" he asked instead.
"Certainly. I can investigate this matter of the footprints later," said Poirot cheerfully.
Instead of following the drive down to the gate, Monsieur Bex turned up a path that branched off at right angles. It led up a slight incline, round to the right of the house, and was bordered on either side by a kind of shrubbery. Suddenly it emerged into a little clearing, from which one obtained a view of the sea. A seat had been placed here, and not far from it was a rather ramshackle shed. A few steps farther on, a neat line of small bushes marked the boundary of the villa grounds. Monsieur Bex pushed his way through these, and we found ourselves on a wide stretch of open downs. I looked round and saw something that filled me with astonishment.
"Why, this is a golf course," I cried.
Bex nodded.
"The links are not completed yet," he explained. "It is hoped to be able to open them sometime next month. It was some of the men working on them who discovered the body early this morning."
I gave a gasp. A little to my left, where for the moment I had overlooked it, was a long, narrow pit, and by it, face downwards, was the body of a man. For a moment my heart gave a terrible leap, and I had a wild fancy that the tragedy had been duplicated. But the commissary dispelled my illusion by moving forward with a sharp exclamation of annoyance.
"What have my police been about? They had strict orders to allow no one near the place without proper credentials."
The man on the ground turned his head over his shoulder.
"But I have proper credentials," he remarked, and rose slowly to his feet. "My dear Monsieur Giraud," cried the commissary, "I had no idea that you had arrived, even. The examining magistrate has been awaiting you with the utmost impatience.
As he spoke, I was scanning the newcomer with the keenest curiosity. The famous detective from the Paris Sûreté was familiar to me by name, and I was extremely interested to see him in the flesh. He was very tall, perhaps about 30 years of age, with auburn hair and moustache, and a military carriage. There was a trace of arrogance in his manner which showed that he was fully alive to his own importance. Bex introduced us, presenting Poirot as a colleague. A flicker of interest came into the detective's eye.
"I know you by name, Monsieur Poirot," he said. "You cut quite a figure in the old days, didn't you? But methods are very different now."
"Crimes, though, are very much the same," remarked Poirot gently. I saw at once that Giraud was prepared to be hostile. He resented the other being associated with him, and I felt that if he came across any clue of importance, he would be more than likely to keep it to himself.
"The examining magistrate," began Bex again,
but Giraud interrupted rudely.
"A fig for the examining magistrate. The light is the important thing. For all practical purposes, it will be gone in another half hour or so. I know all about the case, and the people at the house will do very well until tomorrow. But if we're going to find a clue to the murderers, here is the spot we shall find it. Is it your police who have been trampling all over the place? I thought they knew better nowadays."
"Assuredly they do. The marks you complain of were made by the workmen who discovered the body."
The other grunted disgustedly.
"I can see the tracks where the three of them came through the hedge. But they were cunning. You can just recognize the center footmarks as those of Monsieur Renault. But those on either side have been carefully obliterated. Not that there would really be much to see anyway on this hard ground, but they weren't taking any chances."
"The external sign," said Poirot. "That is what you seek, eh?"
The other detective stared.
"Of course."
A very faint smile came to Poirot's lips. He seemed about to speak, but checked himself. He bent down to where a spade was lying.
"That is what the grave was dug with, right enough," said Giraud. "But you'll get nothing from it. It was Renault's own spade, and the man who used it wore gloves. Here they are."
He gesticulated with his foot to where two soil-stained gloves were lying.
"And they're Renault's too, or at least his gardener's. I tell you, the men who carried out this crime were taking no chances. The man was stabbed with his own dagger, and would have been buried with his own spade. They counted on leaving no traces, but I'll beat them. There's always something, and I mean to find it."
But Poirot was now apparently interested in something else, a short, discolored piece of lead piping, which lay beside the spade. He touched it delicately with his finger.
"And does this, too, belong to the murdered man?" he asked,
and I thought I detected a subtle flavor of irony in the question. Giraud shrugged his shoulders to indicate that he neither knew nor cared.
"May have been lying around here for weeks. Anyway, it doesn't interest me."
"I, on the contrary, find it very interesting," said Poirot sweetly.
I guessed that he was merely bent on annoying the Paris detective, and if so, he succeeded. The other turned away rudely, remarking that he had no time to waste, and bending down he resumed his minute search of the ground. Meanwhile, Poirot, as though struck by a sudden idea, stepped back over the boundary and tried the door of the little shed.
"That's locked," said Giraud over his shoulder. "But it's only a place where the gardener keeps his rubbish. The spade didn't come from there, but from the tool shed up by the house."
"Marvelous," murmured Monsieur Bex ecstatically to me. "He has been here but half an hour, and he already knows everything. What a man! Undoubtedly, Giraud is the greatest detective alive today."
Although I disliked the detective heartily, I nevertheless was secretly impressed. Efficiency seemed to radiate from the man. I could not help feeling that so far Poirot had not greatly distinguished himself, and it vexed me. He seemed to be directing his attention to all sorts of silly, puerile points that had nothing to do with the case. Indeed, at this juncture, he suddenly asked,
"Monsieur Bex, tell me, I pray you, the meaning of this whitewashed line that extends all round the grave? Is it a device of the police?"
No, Monsieur Poirot. It is an affair of the golf course. It shows that there is to be a bunker, as you call it."
"A bunker?"
Poirot turned to me.
"That is the irregular hole filled with sand and a bank at one side, is it not?"
I concurred.
"Monsieur Renault, without doubt,
He played the golf?
Yes, he was a keen golfer. It is mainly owing to him and to his large subscriptions that this work is being carried forward. He even had a say in the designing of it.
Poirot nodded thoughtfully. Then he remarked,
It was not a very good choice they made.
Of a spot to bury the body?
When the men began to dig up the ground, all would have been discovered.
Exactly, cried Giraud triumphantly, and that proves that they were strangers to the place. It's an excellent piece of indirect evidence.
Yes, said Poirot doubtfully. No one who knew would bury a body there, unless they wanted it to be discovered.
And that is clearly absurd, is it not?
Giraud did not even trouble to reply.
Yes, said Poirot, in a somewhat dissatisfied voice. Yes, undoubtedly. Absurd.
Chapter 7 The Mysterious Madame d'Aubray. As we retraced our steps to the house, Monsieur Bex excused himself for leaving us, explaining that he must immediately acquaint the examining magistrate with the fact of Giraud's arrival. Giraud himself had been obviously delighted when Poirot declared that he had seen all he wanted. The last thing we observed as we left the spot was Giraud crawling about on all fours with a thoroughness in his search that I could not but admire. Poirot guessed my thoughts, for as soon as we were alone, he remarked ironically, At last you have seen the detective you admire, the human foxhound. Is it not so, my friend? Well, at any rate, he's doing something, I said with asperity. If there's anything to find, he'll find it. Now you, eh bien, I also have found something, a piece of lead piping.
Nonsense, Poirot. You know very well that's got nothing to do with it.
I mean little things, traces that may lead us infallibly to the murderers.
Mon ami, a clue of 2 feet long is every bit as valuable as one measuring 2 millimeters.
But it is the romantic idea that all important clues must be infinitesimal. As to the piece of lead piping, having nothing to do with the crime, you say that because Giraud told you so.
No.
As I was about to interpose a question,
we will say no more. Leave Giraud to his search and me to my ideas.
The case seems straightforward enough, and yet, mon ami, I am not satisfied.
And do you know why?
Because of the wristwatch that is 2 hours fast.
And then there are several curious little points that do not seem to fit in. For instance, if the object of the murderers was revenge, why did they not stab Renault in his sleep and have done with it?
They wanted the secret, I reminded him.
Poirot brushed a speck of dust from his sleeve with a dissatisfied air.
Well, where is this secret?
Presumably some distance away, since they wish him to dress himself, yet he is found murdered, close at hand, almost within earshot of the house.
Then again, it is pure chance that a weapon such as the dagger should be lying about casually, ready to hand.
He paused, frowning, and then went on.
Why did the servants hear nothing? Were they drugged?
Was there an accomplice? And did that accomplice see to it that the front door should remain open?
I wonder if...
He stopped abruptly. We had reached the drive in front of the house. Suddenly he turned to me. My friend, I am about to surprise you, to please you. I have taken your reproaches to heart. We will examine some footprints.
Where?
In that right-hand bed yonder. Monsieur Bex says that they are footmarks of the gardener. Let us see if this is so.
See, he approaches with his wheelbarrow.
Indeed, an elderly man was just crossing the drive with a barrow full of seedlings. Poirot called to him, and he set down the barrow and came hobbling towards us.
You're going to ask him for one of his boots to compare with the footmarks? I asked breathlessly.
My faith in Poirot revived a little. Since he said the footprints in this right-hand bed were important, presumably they were.
Exactly, said Poirot.
But won't he think it very odd?
He will not think anything about it at all.
We could say no more, for the old man had joined us.
You want me for something, monsieur?
Yes, you have been gardener here for a long time, haven't you?
24 years, monsieur.
And your name is...
Auguste, monsieur.
I was admiring these magnificent geraniums. They are truly superb. They have been planted long?
Some time, monsieur. But, of course, to keep the beds looking smart, one must keep bedding out a few new plants and remove those that are over. besides keeping the old blooms well picked off.
You put in some new plants yesterday, didn't you? Those in the middle there, and in the other bed also.
Monsieur has a sharp eye. It takes always a day or so for them to pick up. Yes, I put 10 new plants in each bed last night. As Monsieur doubtless knows, one should not put in plants when the sun is hot.
Auguste was charmed with Poirot's interest, and was quite inclined to be garrulous.
That is a splendid specimen there, said Poirot, pointing. Might I perhaps have a cutting of it?
Oh, but certainly, monsieur.
The old fellow stepped into the bed and carefully took a slip from the plant Poirot had admired. Poirot was profuse in his thanks, and Auguste departed to his barrow.
You see, said Poirot with a smile, as he bent over the bed to examine the indentation of the gardener's hobnailed boot. It is quite simple.
I did not realize that the foot would be inside the boot.
You do not use your excellent mental capacity sufficiently.
Well, what of the footmark?
I examined the bed carefully. All the footmarks in the bed were made by the same boot, I said at length after a careful study.
You think so?
Eh bien, I agree with you, said Poirot.
He seemed quite uninterested, and as though he were thinking of something else. At any rate, I remarked, you will have one bee less in your bonnet now.
Mon Dieu! But what an idiom!
What does it mean? What I meant was that now you will give up your interest in these footmarks. But to my surprise, Poirot shook his head.
No, no, mon ami.
At last I am on the right track. I am still in the dark, but, as I hinted just now to Monsieur Bex, these footmarks are the most important and interesting things in the case.
That poor Giraud. I should not be surprised if he took no notice of them whatever.
At that moment the front door opened, and Monsieur Hotet and the commissioner came down the steps.
"Ah, Monsieur Poirot, we were coming to look for you," said the magistrate. "It is getting late, but I wish to pay a visit to Madame d'Aubray. Without doubt she will be very much upset by Monsieur Renaud's death, and we may be fortunate enough to get a clue from her, the secret that he did not confide to his wife. It is possible that he may have told it to the woman whose love held him enslaved. We know where our Samsons are weak, don't we?"
We said no more, but fell into line. Poirot walked with the examining magistrate, and the commissary and I followed a few paces behind.
"There is no doubt that Francois's story is substantially correct," he remarked to me in a confidential tone. "I have been telephoning headquarters. It seems that 3 times in the last 6 weeks, that is to say, since the arrival of Monsieur Renaud at Merlinville, Madame d'Aubray has paid a large sum in notes into her banking account. Altogether, the sum totals 200,000 francs.
Dear me, I said, considering, that must be something like £4,000.
Precisely. Yes, there can be no doubt that he was absolutely infatuated. But it remains to be seen whether he confided his secret to her. The examining magistrate is hopeful, but I hardly dare share his views.
During this conversation, we were walking down the lane towards the fork in the road where our car had halted earlier in the afternoon. And in another moment I realized that the Villa Marguerite, the home of the mysterious Madame d'Aubray, was the small house from which the beautiful girl had emerged.
"She has lived here for many years," said the commissary, nodding his head towards the house, "very quietly, very unobtrusively. She seems to have no friends or relations other than the acquaintances she has made in Merlinville. She never refers to the past, nor to her husband. One does not even know if he is alive or dead. There is a mystery about her, you comprehend?"
I nodded, my interest growing.
"And the daughter?" I ventured. "A truly beautiful young girl, modest, devout, all that she should be. One pities her. For though she may know nothing of the past, a man who wants to ask her hand in marriage must necessarily inform himself. And then—"
The commissary shrugged his shoulders cynically.
"But it would not be her fault," I cried, with rising indignation.
"No? But what will you? A man is particular about his wife's antecedents."
I was prevented from further argument by our arrival at the door. Monsieur Hotet rang the bell. A few minutes elapsed, and then we heard a footfall within, and the door was opened. On the threshold stood my young goddess of that afternoon. When she saw us, the colour left her cheeks, leaving her deathly white, and her eyes widened with apprehension. There was no doubt about it. She was afraid.
"Mademoiselle Dobray," said Monsieur Hotet, sweeping off his hat, "we regret infinitely to disturb you, but the exigencies of the law, you comprehend? My compliments to Madame your mother, and will she have the goodness to grant me a few moments' interview?"
For the moment, the girl stood motionless. Her left hand was pressed to her side as though to still the sudden unconquerable agitation of her heart, but she mastered herself and said in a low voice,
"I will go and see. Please, come inside."
She entered a room on the left of the hall, and we heard the low murmur of her voice, and then another voice, much the same in timbre, but with a slightly harder inflection behind its mellow roundness, said,
"But certainly, ask them to enter."
In another minute we were face to face with the mysterious Madame de Breuil. She was not nearly so tall as her daughter, and the rounded curves of her figure had all the grace of full maturity. Her hair, again, unlike her daughter's, was dark, and parted in the middle, in the Madonna style. Her eyes, half hidden by the drooping lids, were blue. Though very well preserved, she was certainly no longer young, but her charm was of the quality which is independent of age.
"You wish to see me, monsieur?" she asked.
"Yes, madame." Monsieur Hotet cleared his throat. "I am investigating the death of Monsieur Renaud. You have heard of it, no doubt?"
She bowed her head without speaking. Her expression did not change.
We came to ask whether you can throw any light upon the circumstances surrounding it."
"I?"
The surprise of her tone was excellent.
"Yes, madame. We have reason to believe that you were in the habit of visiting the dead man at his villa in the evenings. Is that so?"
The colour rose in the lady's pale cheeks, but she replied quietly,
"I deny your right to ask me such a question."
"Madame, we are investigating a murder."
"Well, what of it?"
"I had nothing to do with the murder." "Madame, we do not say that for a moment, but you knew the dead man well. Did he ever confide in you as to any danger that threatened him?"
"Never."
"Did he ever mention his life in Santiago, and any enemies he may have made there?"
"No."
"Then you can give us no help at all."
"I fear not. I really do not see why you should come to me. Cannot his wife tell you what you want to know?"
Her voice held a slender inflection of irony.
"Mrs. Renaud has told us all she can."
"Ah," said Madame de Breuil, "I wonder."
"You wonder what, madame?"
"Nothing."
The examining magistrate looked at her. He was aware that he was fighting a duel, and that he had no mean antagonist.
"You persist in your statement that Monsieur Renaud confided nothing to you?"
"Why should you think it likely that he should confide in me?"
"Because, madame," said Monsieur Hotet with calculated brutality, "a man tells to his mistress what he does not always tell to his wife."
"Ah!" She sprang forward. Her eyes flashed fire.
"Monsieur, you insult me, and before my daughter, I can tell you nothing. Have the goodness to leave my house."
The honours undoubtedly rested with the lady. We left the Villa Marguerite like a shame-faced pack of schoolboys. The magistrate muttered angry ejaculations to himself. Poirot seemed lost in thought. Suddenly, he came out of his reverie with a start, and inquired of Monsieur Hotet if there was a good hotel near at hand.
There is a small place, the Hôtel des Bains, on this side of the town, a few hundred yards down the road. It will be handy for your investigations. We shall see you in the morning, then, I presume."
"Yes, I thank you, Monsieur Hotet."
With mutual civilities, we parted company, Poirot and I going towards Melaville, and the others returning to the Villa Genevieve.
"The French police system is very marvellous," said Poirot, looking after them. "The information they possess about everyone's life, down to the most commonplace detail, is extraordinary. Though he has only been here a little over 6 weeks, they are perfectly well acquainted with Monsieur Renaud's tastes and pursuits, and at a moment's notice they can produce information as to Madame Dobray's banking account and the sums that have lately been paid in. Undoubtedly, the dossier is a great institution."
"But what is that?" He turned sharply. A figure was running hatless down the road after us. It was Marta de Breuil.
"I beg your pardon," she cried breathlessly as she reached us. I should not do this. I know. You must not tell my mother. But is it true, what the people say, that Monsieur Renaud called in a detective before he died, and that you are he?"
"Yes, mademoiselle," said Poirot gently. "It is quite true.
But how did you learn it?"
"Françoise told our Amélie,"
explained Marta with a blush. Poirot made a grimace. "This secrecy, it is impossible in an affair of this kind, not that it matters. Well, mademoiselle, what is it you want to know?" The girl hesitated. She seemed longing, yet fearing, to speak. At last, almost in a whisper, she asked,
"Is anyone suspected?"
Poirot eyed her keenly. Then he replied evasively, "Suspicion is in the air at present, mademoiselle."
"Yes, I know, but anyone in particular?"
"Why do you want to know?" The girl seemed frightened by the question. All at once, Poirot's words about her earlier in the day occurred to me. The girl with the anxious eyes.
"Monsieur Renaud was always very kind to me," she replied at last. "It is natural that I should be interested."
"I see," said Poirot.
"Well, mademoiselle, suspicion at present is hovering round two persons."
"Two?"
I could have sworn there was a note of surprise and relief in her voice. "Their names are unknown, but they are presumed to be Chileans from Santiago. And now, mademoiselle, you see what comes of being young and beautiful? I have betrayed professional secrets for you." The girl laughed merrily, and then, rather shyly, she thanked him.
"I must run back now. Maman will miss me."
And she turned and ran back up the road, looking like a modern Atalanta. I stared after her.
"Mon ami," said Poirot, in his gentle, ironical voice, "is it that we are to remain planted here all night, just because you have seen a beautiful young woman and your head is in a whirl?"
I laughed and apologized. "But she is beautiful, Poirot. Anyone might be excused for being bowled over by her." But to my surprise, Poirot shook his head very earnestly.
"Ah, mon ami, do not set your heart on Marthe de Breuil. She is not for you, that one. Take it from Papa Poirot."
"Why?" I cried. "The commissary assured me that she was as good as she is beautiful. A perfect angel."
"Some of the greatest criminals I have known had the faces of angels," remarked Poirot cheerfully. "A malformation of the grey cells may coincide quite easily with the face of a Madonna."
"Poirot," I cried, horrified, "you cannot mean that you suspect an innocent child like this."
Ta-ta-ta, do not excite yourself. I have not said that I suspected her. But you must admit that her anxiety to know about the case is somewhat unusual."
"For once, I see farther than you do," I said. "Her anxiety is not for herself, but for her mother."
"My friend," said Poirot, "as usual, you see nothing at all. Madame de Breuil is very well able to look after herself without her daughter worrying about her. I admit I was teasing you just now, but all the same I repeat what I said before. Do not set your heart on that girl. She is not for you. I, Hercule Poirot, know it. Sacré! If only I could remember where I had seen that face."
"What face?" I asked, surprised. "The daughter's?"
"No, the mother's."
Noting my surprise, he nodded emphatically. "But yes,
it is as I tell you. It was a long time ago, when I was still with the police in Belgium. I have never actually seen the woman before, but I have seen her picture, and in connection with some case. I rather fancy—"
"Yes?"
"I may be mistaken, but I rather fancy that it was a murder case."
Chapter 8. An Unexpected Meeting. We were up at the villa betimes next morning. The man on guard at the gate did not bar our way this time. Instead, he respectfully saluted us, and we passed on to the house. The maid, Leonie, was just coming down the stairs and seemed not averse to the prospect of a little conversation. Poirot inquired after the health of Mrs. Renaud. Leonie shook her head.
"She is terribly upset, the poor lady. She will eat nothing, but nothing, and she is as pale as a ghost. It is heartrending to see her. Ah, it is not I who would grieve like that for a man who had deceived me with another woman."
Poirot nodded sympathetically. "What you say is very just.
But what will you? The heart of a woman who loves will forgive many blows. Still, undoubtedly there must have been many scenes of recrimination between them in the last few months. Again Léonie shook her head.
Never, monsieur. Never have I heard Madame utter a word of protest, of reproach even. She had the temper and disposition of an angel, quite different to monsieur.
Monsieur Renaud had not the temper of an angel?
Far from it. When he enraged himself, the whole house knew of it. The day that he quarrelled with Monsieur Jacques, ma foi! They might have been heard in the marketplace, they shouted so loud.
Indeed, said Poirot.
And when did this quarrel take place?
Oh, it was just before Monsieur Jacques went to Paris. Almost he missed the train. He came out of the library and caught up his bag, which he had left in the hall, the automobile, it was being repaired, and he had to run for the station. I was dusting the salon, and I saw him pass, and his face was white, white, with two burning spots of red. Ah, but he was angry.
Léonie was enjoying her narrative thoroughly.
And the dispute? What was it about?
Ah, that I do not know, confessed Léonie. It is true that they shouted, but their voices were so loud and high, and they spoke so fast, that only one well acquainted with English could have comprehended. But, monsieur, he was like a thundercloud all day. Impossible to please him.
The sound of a door shutting upstairs cut short Léonie's loquacity.
And Françoise, who awaits me,
she exclaimed, awakening to a tardy remembrance of her duties.
That old one, she always scolds.
One moment, mademoiselle. The examining magistrate, where is he?
They have gone out to look at the automobile in the garage. Monsieur the commissary had some idea that it might have been used on the night of the murder.
Quelle idée, murmured Poirot as the girl disappeared. You will go out and join them?
No. I shall await their return in the salon. It is cool there on this hot morning.
This placid way of taking things did not quite commend itself to me. If you don't mind, I said and hesitated,
not in the least. You wish to investigate on your own account, eh?
Well, I'd rather like to have a look at Giraud, if he's anywhere about, and see what he's up to.
The human foxhound, murmured Poirot, as he leaned back in a comfortable chair and closed his eyes.
By all means, my friend. Au revoir. I strolled out of the front door. It was certainly hot. I turned up the path we had taken the day before. I had a mind to study the scene of the crime myself. I did not go directly to the spot, however, but turned aside into the bushes, so as to come out on the links some 100 yards or so further to the right. The shrubbery here was much denser, and I had quite a struggle to force my way through. When I emerged at last on the course, it was quite unexpectedly and with such vigour that I cannoned heavily into a young lady who had been standing with her back to the plantation. She not unnaturally gave a suppressed shriek, but I, too, uttered an exclamation of surprise, for it was my friend of the train, Cinderella. The surprise was mutual.
You!
We both exclaimed simultaneously. The young lady recovered herself first.
My only aunt! She exclaimed. What are you doing here?
For the matter of that, what are you? I retorted.
When I last saw you, the day before yesterday, you were trotting home to England like a good little boy.
When I last saw you, I said, you were trotting home with your sister, like a good little girl. By the way, how is your sister? A flash of white teeth rewarded me.
How kind of you to ask. My sister is well, I thank you.
She is here with you?
She remained in town, said the minx with dignity.
I don't believe you've got a sister, I laughed. If you have, her name is Harris.
Do you remember mine? She asked with a smile.
Cinderella. But you're going to tell me the real one now, aren't you? She shook her head with a wicked look. Not even why you're here?
Oh, that.
I suppose you've heard of members of my profession resting at expensive French watering places. Dirt cheap if you know where to go. I eyed her keenly. Still, you'd no intention of coming here when I met you 2 days ago.
We all have our disappointments, said Miss Cinderella sententiously. There now. I've told you quite as much as is good for you. Little boys should not be inquisitive. You've not yet told me what you're doing here.
Oh, you remember my telling you that my great friend was a detective?
Yes.
And perhaps you've heard about this crime at the Villa Genevieve.
She stared at me. Her breast heaved, and her eyes grew wide and round.
You don't mean that you're in on that?
I nodded. There was no doubt I had scored heavily. Her emotion, as she regarded me, was only too evident.
For some few seconds she remained silent, staring at me. Then she nodded her head emphatically.
"Well, if that doesn't beat the band! Tote me round, I want to see all the horrors."
"What do you mean?
What I say?
Bless the boy, didn't I tell you I doted on crimes? I've been nosing around for hours. It's a real piece of luck happening on you this way. Come on, show me all the sights.
But look here, wait a minute.
I can't, nobody's allowed in, they're awfully strict.
Aren't you and your friends the big bugs?"
I was loath to relinquish my position of importance.
"Why are you so keen?" I asked weakly. "And what is it you want to see?"
"Oh, everything. The place where it happened, and the weapon, and the body, and any fingerprints or interesting things like that. I've never had a chance before of being right in on a murder like this. It'll last me all my life." I turned away, sickened. What were women coming to nowadays? The girl's ghoulish excitement nauseated me.
"Come off your high horse," said the lady suddenly, "and don't give yourself airs. When you got called to this job, did you put your nose in the air and say it was a nasty business and you wouldn't be mixed up in it?"
"No, but if you'd been here on holiday, wouldn't you be nosing around just the same as I am? Of course you would."
"I'm a man. You're a woman."
"Your idea of a woman is someone who gets on a chair and shrieks if she sees a mouse. That's all prehistoric. But you will show me round, won't you? You see, it might make a big difference to me."
"In what way?"
"They're keeping all the reporters out. I might make a big scoop with one of the papers. You don't know how much they'd pay for a bit of inside stuff."
I hesitated.
She slipped a small, soft hand into mine.
"Please, there's a dear."
I capitulated. Secretly, I knew that I should rather enjoy the part of showman. We repaired first to the spot where the body had been discovered. A man was on guard there, who saluted respectfully, knowing me by sight, and raised no questions as to my companion. Presumably he regarded her as vouched for by me. I explained to Cinderella just how the discovery had been made, and she listened attentively, sometimes putting in an intelligent question. Then we turned our steps in the direction of the villa. I proceeded rather cautiously, for truth to tell, I was not at all anxious to meet anyone. I took the girl through the shrubbery, round to the back of the house, where the small shed was. I recollected that yesterday evening, after relocking the door, Monsieur Bex had left the key with the sergeant de ville, Marchaud,
"in case Monsieur Giraud should require it while we are upstairs."
I thought it quite likely that the Sûreté detective, after using it, had returned it to Marchaud again. Leaving the girl out of sight in the shrubbery, I entered the house. Marchaud was on duty outside the door of the salon. From within came the murmur of voices.
"Monsieur desires Monsieur Sûreté? He is within. He is again interrogating Françoise."
"No," I said hastily. "I don't want him, but I should very much like the key of the shed outside, if it's not against regulations."
"Oh, but certainly, monsieur." He produced it. "Here it is. Monsieur Sûreté gave orders that all facilities were to be placed at your disposal. You will return it to me when you have finished out there. That is all."
"Of course." I felt a thrill of satisfaction as I realized that in Marchaud's eyes, at least, I ranked equally in importance with Poirot. The girl was waiting for me. She gave an exclamation of delight as she saw the key in my hand.
"You've got it, then?"
"Well, of course," I said coolly. "All the same, you know what I'm doing is highly irregular."
"You've been a perfect duck, and I shan't forget it. Come along. They can't see us from the house, can they?"
"Oh, wait a minute," I arrested her eager advance. "I won't stop you if you really wish to go in, but do you? You've seen the grave and the grounds, and you've heard all the details of the affair. Isn't that enough for you? This is going to be gruesome, you know, and unpleasant." She looked at me for a moment with an expression that I could not quite fathom. Then she laughed.
"Me for the horrors," she said. "Come along."
In silence, we arrived at the door of the shed. I opened it, and we passed in. I walked over to the body and gently pulled down the sheet, as Bex had done the preceding afternoon. A little gasping sound escaped from the girl's lips, and I turned and looked at her. There was horror on her face now, and those debonair high spirits of hers were quenched utterly. She had not chosen to listen to my advice, and she was punished now for her disregard of it. I felt singularly merciless towards her. She should go through with it now. I turned the corpse over gently. "You see," I said, "he was stabbed in the back." Her voice was almost soundless.
"With what?"
I nodded towards the glass jar. That dagger. Suddenly the girl reeled and then sank down in a heap. I sprang to her assistance. You are faint. Come out of here. It's been too much for you.
Water, she murmured. Quick, water.
I left her and rushed into the house. Fortunately, none of the servants were about, and I was able to secure a glass of water unobserved and add a few drops of brandy from a pocket flask. In a few minutes I was back again. The girl was lying as I had left her, but a few sips of the brandy and water revived her in a marvellous manner.
"Take me out of here! Oh, quickly, quickly!" she cried, shuddering.
Supporting her with my arm, I led her out into the air, and she pulled the door to behind her. Then she drew a deep breath.
"Oh, that's better. Oh, it was horrible. Why did you ever let me go in?"
I felt this to be so feminine that I could not forbear a smile. Secretly, I was not dissatisfied with her collapse. It proved that she was not quite so callous as I had thought her. After all, she was little more than a child, and her curiosity had probably been of the unthinking order. "I did my best to stop you, you know," I said gently.
"I suppose you did. Well, goodbye. Look here, you can't start off like that all alone. You're not fit for it. I insist on accompanying you back to Merlinville."
"Nonsense, I'm quite all right now."
"Supposing you felt faint again? No, I shall come with you."
But this she combated with a great deal of energy. In the end, however, I prevailed, so far as to be allowed to accompany her to the outskirts of the town. We retraced our steps over our former route, passing the grave again, and making a detour onto the road. Where the first straggling line of shops began, she stopped and held out her hand.
"Goodbye, and thank you ever so much for coming with me.
Are you sure you're all right now?"
"Quite, thanks. I hope you don't get into any trouble over showing me things."
I disclaimed the idea lightly.
"Well, goodbye."
"Au revoir," I corrected. "If you're staying here, we shall meet again." She flashed a smile at me.
"That's so. Au revoir, then."
"Oh, wait a second. You haven't told me your address."
"Oh, I'm staying at the Hotel du Phare. It's a little place, but quite good. Come and look me up tomorrow."
"I will," I said, with perhaps rather unnecessary empressement. I watched her out of sight, then turned and retraced my steps to the villa. I remembered that I had not relocked the door of the shed. Fortunately, no one had noticed the oversight, and turning the key, I removed it and returned it to the sergeant de ville. And as I did so, it came upon me suddenly that though Cinderella had given me her address, I still did not know her name. Chapter 9. Monsieur Giraud finds some clues. In the salon, I found the examining magistrate busily interrogating the old gardener, Auguste. Poirot and the commissary, who were both present, greeted me respectively with a smile and a polite bow. I slipped quietly into a seat. Monsieur Hotet was painstaking and meticulous in the extreme, but did not succeed in eliciting anything of importance. The gardening gloves Auguste admitted to be his. He wore them when handling a certain species of primula plant, which was poisonous to some people. He could not say when he had worn them last. Certainly he had not missed them. Where were they kept? Sometimes in one place, sometimes in another. The spade was usually to be found in the small tool shed. Was it locked? Of course it was locked. Where was the key kept? Parbleu! It was in the door, of course. There was nothing of value to steal. Who would have expected a party of bandits or assassins? Such things did not happen in Madame la Vicomtesse's time. Monsieur Hotet, signifying that he had finished with him, the old man withdrew, grumbling to the last. Remembering Poirot's unaccountable insistence on the footprints in the flowerbeds, I scrutinized him narrowly as he gave his evidence. Either he had nothing to do with the crime, or he was a consummate actor. Suddenly, just as he was going out of the door, an idea struck me. "Pardon, Monsieur Hotet," I cried, "but will you permit me to ask him one question?"
"Oh, but certainly, monsieur."
Thus encouraged, I turned to Auguste. "Where do you keep your boots?"
"On my feet," growled the old man. "Where else?"
"But when you go to bed at night?"
"Under my bed."
"But who cleans them?"
"Nobody. Why should they be cleaned? Is it that I promenade myself on the front like a young man? On Sunday I wear the Sunday boots, but otherwise—" He shrugged his shoulders.
I shook my head, discouraged.
"Well, well," said the magistrate. "We do not advance very much. Undoubtedly we are held up until we get the return cable from Santiago. Has anyone seen Giraud?" "In verity, that one lacks politeness. I have a good mind to send for him, and—" "You will not have to send far."
The quiet voice startled us. Giraud was standing outside, looking in through the open window. He leapt lightly into the room and advanced to the table.
"Here I am, at your service. Accept my excuses for not presenting myself sooner." "Not at all, not at all," said the magistrate, rather confused. "Of course, I am only a detective," continued the other. "I know nothing of interrogatories. Were I conducting one, I should be inclined to do so without an open window. Anyone standing outside can so easily hear all that passes, but no matter."
Monsieur Hotet flushed angrily. There was evidently going to be no love lost between the examining magistrate and the detective in charge of the case. They had fallen foul of each other at the start. Perhaps, in any event, it would have been much the same. To Giraud, all examining magistrates were fools, and to Monsieur Hotet, who took himself seriously, the casual manner of the Paris detective could not fail to give offence.
"Eh bien, Monsieur Giraud," said the magistrate rather sharply, "without doubt you have been employing your time to a marvel. You have the names of the assassins for us, have you not? And also the precise spot where they find themselves now."
Unmoved by this irony, Monsieur Giraud replied,
"I know at least where they have come from."
Giraud took two small objects from his pocket and laid them down on the table. We crowded round. The objects were very simple ones, the stub of a cigarette and an unlighted match. The detective wheeled round on Poirot.
"What do you see there?" he asked.
There was something almost brutal in his tone. It made my cheeks flush, but Poirot remained unmoved. He shrugged his shoulders. "A cigarette end and a match."
"And what does that tell you?"
Poirot spread out his hands.
"It tells me nothing."
"Ah,"
said Giraud in a satisfied voice.
"You haven't made a study of these things. That's not an ordinary match. Not in this country, at least. It's common enough in South America. Luckily, it's unlighted. I mightn't have recognized it otherwise. Evidently, one of the men threw away his cigarette and lit another, spilling one match out of the box as he did so."
"And the other match?" asked Poirot.
"Which match?"
"The one he did light his cigarette with. You have found that also?"
"No."
"Perhaps you did not search very thoroughly."
"Not search thoroughly?"
For a moment, it seemed as though the detective was going to break out angrily, but with an effort, he controlled himself.
"I see you love a joke, Monsieur Poirot. But in any case, match or no match, the cigarette end would be sufficient. It is a South American cigarette, with licorice pectoral pepper."
Poirot bowed. The commissary spoke.
"The cigarette end and the match might have belonged to Monsieur Renault. Remember, it is only 2 years since he returned from South America."
"No,"
replied the other confidently.
"I have already searched among the effects of Monsieur Renault. The cigarettes he smoked and the matches he used are quite different."
"You do not think it odd," asked Poirot, "that these strangers should come unprovided with a weapon? With gloves, with a spade, and that they should so conveniently find all these things?"
Giraud smiled in a rather superior manner.
"Undoubtedly it is strange. Indeed, without the theory that I hold, it would be inexplicable."
"Aha," said Monsieur Hotet. "An accomplice within the house, or outside it," said Giraud with a peculiar smile.
"But someone must have admitted them. We cannot allow that by an unparalleled piece of good fortune they found the door ajar for them to walk in.
The door was opened for them, but it could just as easily be opened from outside by someone who possessed a key."
"But who did possess a key?"
Giraud shrugged his shoulders.
"As for that, no one who possesses one is going to admit the fact if he can help it. But several people might have had one. Monsieur Jacques Renault, the son, for instance. It is true that he is on his way to South America, but he might have lost the key or had it stolen from him. Then there is the gardener. He has been here many years. One of the younger servants may have a lover. It is easy to take an impression of a key and have one cut. There are many possibilities. Then there is another person who, I should judge, is exceedingly likely to have such a thing."
"Who is that?"
"Madame Dubreuil," said the detective.
"Ah, ah," said the magistrate. "So you have heard about that, have you?"
"I hear everything," said Giraud imperturbably.
"There is one thing I could swear you have not heard," said Monsieur Hotet, delighted to be able to show superior knowledge, and without more ado he retailed the story of the mysterious visitor the night before. He also touched on the check made out to Duveen, and finally handed Giraud the letter signed Bella. "All very interesting, but my theory remains unaffected."
"And your theory is?"
"For the moment I prefer not to say. Remember, I am only just beginning my investigations."
"Tell me one thing, Monsieur Giraud," said Poirot suddenly. "Your theory allows for the door being opened. It does not explain why it was left open. When they departed, would it not have been natural for them to close it behind them? If a sergeant de ville had chanced to come up to the house, as is sometimes done, to see that all is well, they might have been discovered and overtaken almost at once."
"Bah! They forgot it. A mistake, I grant you."
Then, to my surprise, Poirot uttered almost the same words as he had uttered to Bex the previous evening.
"I do not agree with you. The door being left open was the result of either design or necessity, and any theory that does not admit that fact is bound to prove vain."
We all regarded the little man with a good deal of astonishment. The confession of ignorance drawn from him over the match-end had, I thought, been bound to humiliate him. But here he was, as self-satisfied as ever, laying down the law to Giraud without a tremor. The detective, twisting his moustache, eyed my friend in a somewhat bantering fashion.
"You don't agree with me, eh? Well, what strikes you particularly about the case? Let's hear your views."
"One thing presents itself to me as being significant. Tell me, Monsieur Giraud, does nothing strike you as familiar about this case? Is there nothing it reminds you of?"
"Familiar? Reminds me of? I can't say offhand. I don't think so, no."
"You are wrong," said Poirot quietly. "A crime almost precisely similar has been committed before."
"When? And where?"
"Ah, that, unfortunately, I cannot for the moment remember, but I shall do so. I had hoped you might be able to assist me."
Giraud snorted incredulously. "Oh, there have been many affairs of masked men. I cannot remember the details of them all. The crimes all resemble each other more or less."
"There is such a thing as the individual touch." Poirot suddenly assumed his lecturing manner and addressed us collectively. "I am speaking to you now of the psychology of crime. Monsieur Giraud knows quite well that each criminal has his particular method, and that the police, when called in to investigate, say, a case of burglary, can often make a shrewd guess at the offender simply by the peculiar methods he has employed. Jap would tell you the same, Hastings. Man is an unoriginal animal. Unoriginal within the law in his daily respectable life, equally unoriginal outside the law. If a man commits a crime, any other crime he commits will resemble it closely. The English murderer who disposed of his wives in succession by drowning them in their baths was a case in point. Had he varied his methods, he might have escaped detection to this day, but he obeyed the common dictates of human nature, arguing that what had once succeeded would succeed again, and he paid the penalty of his lack of originality."
"And the point of all this?" sneered Giraud.
"That when you have two crimes precisely similar in design and execution, you find the same brain behind them both. I am looking for that brain, Monsieur Giraud, and I shall find it. Here we have a true clue, a psychological clue. You may know all about cigarettes and match-ends, Monsieur Giraud, but I, Hercule Poirot, know the mind of man."
Giraud remained singularly unimpressed.
"For your guidance," continued Poirot, "I will also advise you of one fact which might fail to be brought to your notice. The wristwatch of Madame Renaud on the day following the tragedy had gained 2 hours.
Giraud stared.
"Perhaps it was in the habit of gaining."
"As a matter of fact, I am told it did."
"Very well, then."
"All the same, 2 hours is a good deal," said Poirot softly. "Then there is the matter of the footprints in the flower bed."
He nodded his head towards the open window. Giraud took 2 eager strides and looked out.
"But I see no footprints."
"No,"
said Poirot. straightening a little pile of books on a table. "There are none." For a moment, an almost murderous rage obscured Giraud's face. He took two strides towards his tormentor, but at that moment the salon door was opened, and Marchaud announced,
"Monsieur Stoner, the secretary, has just arrived from England. May he enter?"
Chapter 10 Gabriel Stoner. The man who now entered the room was a striking figure. Very tall, with a well-knit athletic frame and a deeply bronzed face and neck, he dominated the assembly. Even Giraud seemed anemic beside him. When I knew him better, I realized that Gabriel Stoner was quite an unusual personality. English by birth, he had knocked about all over the world. He had shot big game in Africa, traveled in Korea, ranched in California, and traded in the South Sea Islands. His unerring eye picked out Monsieur Hote.
The examining magistrate in charge of the case?
Pleased to meet you, sir.
This is a terrible business. How's Mrs. Renault? Is she bearing up fairly well? Must have been an awful shock to her.
Terrible, terrible, said Monsieur Hote. Permit me to introduce Monsieur Bex, our commissary of police, Monsieur Giraud of the Sûreté. This gentleman is Monsieur Hercule Poirot. Monsieur Renault sent for him, but he arrived too late to do anything to avert the tragedy. A friend of Monsieur Poirot's, Captain Hastings.
Stoner looked at Poirot with some interest.
Sent for you, did he?
You did not know, then, that Monsieur Renault contemplated calling a detective?
Interposed Monsieur Bex.
No, I didn't. But it doesn't surprise me a bit.
Why?
Because the old man was rattled. I don't know what it was all about. He didn't confide in me. We weren't on those terms, but rattled he was, and badly.
Said Monsieur Hote. But you have no notion of the cause.
That's what I said, sir.
You will pardon me, Monsieur Stoner, but we must begin with a few formalities. Your name?
Gabriel Stoner.
How long ago was it that you became secretary to Monsieur Renault?
About 2 years ago, when he first arrived from South America. I met him through a mutual friend, and he offered me the post. A thundering good boss he was, too.
Did he talk to you much about his life in South America?
Yes, a good bit.
Do you know if he was ever in Santiago?
Several times, I believe. He never mentioned any special incident that occurred there? Anything that might have provoked some vendetta against him?
Never. Did he speak of any secret that he had acquired while sojourning there?
Not that I can remember. But for all that, there was a mystery about him. I've never heard him speak of his boyhood, for instance, or of any incident prior to his arrival in South America. He was a French-Canadian by birth, I believe. But I've never heard him speak of his life in Canada. He could shut up like a clam if he liked.
So far as you know, he had no enemies, and you can give us no clue as to any secret, to obtain possession of which he might have been murdered?
That's so.
Monsieur Stoner, have you ever heard of the name of Duveen in connection with Monsieur Renault?
Duveen. Duveen. He tried the name over thoughtfully.
I don't think I have. And yet, it seems familiar. Do you know a lady, a friend of Monsieur Renault's, whose Christian name is Bella?
Again, Mr. Stoner shook his head.
Bella Duveen. Is that the full name?
It's curious.
I'm sure I know it, but for the moment I can't remember in what connection.
The magistrate coughed.
You understand, Monsieur Stoner. The case is like this. There must be no reservations. You might perhaps, through a feeling of consideration for Madame Renault, for whom I gather you have a great esteem and affection, you might, in fact, said Monsieur Hote, getting rather tied up in his sentence, there must be absolutely no reservations.
Stoner stared at him, a dawning light of comprehension in his eyes.
I don't quite get you, he said gently.
Where does Mrs. Renault come in?
I've an immense respect and affection for that lady. She's a very wonderful and unusual type, but I don't quite see how my reservations or otherwise could affect her.
Not if this Bella Duveen should prove to have been something more than a friend to her husband?
Ah, said Stoner. I get you now. But I'll bet my bottom dollar that you're wrong. The old man never so much as looked at a petticoat. He just adored his own wife. They were the most devoted couple I know.
Monsieur Hotet shook his head gently. Monsieur Stoner, we hold absolute proof. A love letter, written by this Bella to Monsieur Renaud, accusing him of having tired of her. Moreover, we have further proof that at the time of his death he was carrying on an intrigue with a Frenchwoman, a Madame d'Aubreuil, who rents the adjoining villa. The secretary's eyes narrowed.
Hold on, sir. You're barking up the wrong tree. I knew Paul Renaud. What you've just been saying is plumb impossible. There's some other explanation.
The magistrate shrugged his shoulders.
What other explanation could there be?
What leads you to think it was a love affair?
Madame d'Aubreuil was in the habit of visiting him here in the evenings. Also, since Monsieur Renaud came to the Villa Geneviève, Madame d'Aubreuil has paid large sums of money into the bank in notes. In all, the amount totals £4,000 of your English money.
I guess that's right, said Stoner quietly. I transmitted him those sums in notes at his request. But it wasn't an intrigue.
What else could it be?
Blackmail, said Stoner sharply, bringing down his hand with a slam on the table. That's what it was.
Ah!
Cried the magistrate, shaken in spite of himself.
Blackmail, repeated Stoner. The old man was being bled, and at a good rate, too. 4,000 in a couple of months.
I told you just now there was a mystery about Renaud. Evidently this Madame d'Aubreuil knew enough of it to put the screw on.
It is possible, the commissary cried excitedly. Decidedly, it is possible.
Possible? Roared Stoner. It's certain. Tell me, have you asked Mrs. Renaud about this love affair stunt of yours?
No, monsieur. We did not wish to occasion her any distress, if it could be reasonably avoided.
Distress? Why, she'd laugh in your face. I tell you, she and Renaud were a couple in 100.
Ah, that reminds me of another point, said Monsieur Hotet.
Did Monsieur Renaud take you into his confidence at all as to the dispositions of his will?
Well, I know all about it. Took it to the lawyers for him after he'd drawn it out. I can give you the name of his solicitors if you want to see it. They've got it there. Quite simple. Half in trust to his wife for her lifetime, the other half to his son. Few legacies. I rather think he left me 1,000.
When was this will drawn up?
Oh, about 1.5 years ago.
Would it surprise you very much, Monsieur Stoner, to hear that Monsieur Renaud had made another will less than a fortnight ago?
Stoner was obviously very much surprised.
I'd no idea of it. What's it like?
The whole of his vast fortune is left unreservedly to his wife. There is no mention of his son.
Mr. Stoner gave vent to a prolonged whistle.
I call that rather rough on the lad. His mother adores him, of course, but to the world at large it looks rather like a want of confidence on his father's part.
It'll be rather galling to his pride.
Still, it all goes to prove what I told you, that Renaud and his wife were on first-rate terms.
Quite so, said Monsieur Hotet. It is possible we shall have to revise our ideas on several points. We have, of course, cabled to Santiago and are expecting a reply from there any minute. In all probability, everything will then be perfectly clear and straightforward. On the other hand, if your suggestion of blackmail is true, Madame d'Aubreuil ought to be able to give us valuable information.
Poirot interjected a remark.
Monsieur Stoner, the English chauffeur, Masters, had he been long with Monsieur Renaud?
Over 1 year.
Have you any idea whether he has ever been in South America?
Well, I'm quite sure he hasn't. Before coming to Monsieur Renaud, he had been for many years with some people in Gloucestershire, whom I know well.
In fact, you can answer for him as being above suspicion?
Absolutely.
Poirot seemed somewhat crestfallen. Meanwhile, the magistrate had summoned Marchaux.
My compliments to Madame Renaud. I should be glad to speak to her for a few minutes. Beg her not to disturb herself. I will wait upon her upstairs.
Marchaux saluted and disappeared. We waited some minutes, and then, to our surprise, the door opened, and Mrs. Renaud, deathly pale, in her heavy mourning, entered the room. Monsieur Hotet brought forward a chair, uttering vigorous protestations, and she thanked him with a smile. Stoner was holding one hand of hers in his with an eloquent sympathy. Words evidently failed him.
Mrs. Renault turned to Monsieur Hotet.
"You wish to ask me something?"
"With your permission, madame. I understand your husband was a French-Canadian by birth. Can you tell me anything of his youth or upbringing?"
She shook her head.
"My husband was always very reticent about himself, monsieur. He came from the northwest, I know, but I fancy that he had an unhappy childhood, for he never cared to speak of that time. Our life was lived entirely in the present and the future."
"Was there any mystery in his past life?"
Mrs. Renault smiled a little and shook her head.
"Nothing so romantic, I am sure, monsieur."
Monsieur Hotet also smiled.
"True. We must not permit ourselves to get melodramatic. There is one thing more."
He hesitated. Stoner broke in impetuously.
"They've got an extraordinary idea in their heads, Mrs. Renault. They actually fancy that Mr. Renault is carrying on an intrigue with a Madame de Breuil, who it seems lives next door."
The scarlet colour flamed into Mrs. Renault's cheeks. She flung her head up, then bit her lip, her face quivering. Stoner stood looking at her in astonishment, but Monsieur Bex leaned forward and said gently,
"We regret to cause you pain, madame. But have you any reason to believe that Madame de Breuil was your husband's mistress?"
With a sob of anguish, Mrs. Renault buried her face in her hands. Her shoulders heaved convulsively. At last she lifted her head and said brokenly,
"She may have been."
Never in all my life have I seen anything to equal the blank amazement on Stoner's face. He was thoroughly taken aback.